Okay, good morning everybody. This is Bio 231 and it's February 24th, Wednesday. And let's see, I think starting next week on Wednesday, practicums and labs start again. Okay, so don't forget there's that extra study room that's just outside of anatomy lab. Look at the posted schedule there if you need to go in and look at some bones. And in some of my labs, we actually have to do the integument model as well. So if you need to look at that model again, you're welcome to do that. But in Blackboard, you have some videos that go over those things. So you may or may not have to go to that extra study room. All right, so we're going to finish up axial skeleton today and go on to appendicular skeleton. So I did have a little flash quiz here for skull bones because I do want you to know the disarticulated bones of the skull. And you have that video on my website to look at if you want to do the same kind of exercise at home. All right, so when I show you the picture, you got to identify the bone. Now, don't forget, for the practicum, you probably also have to identify different landmarks on that bone as well, but we're not going to take time to go over all the landmarks. I just want you to be able to pick out the disarticulated skull bone. All right, so here's one right here. What's that? Frontal bone, that's pretty easy, right? Like here's a superior orbital notch right here. Sometimes you have a foramen, glabella, the orbital plate. And then there's a big hole. What do we call that big hole in the frontal bone? Which would be about in this region right here. Okay, the glabella is the prominence, is that projection coming out, which is making room for that hole in there. And so that's called the frontal sinus. It's a paranasal sinus, right? So don't forget, you got to know four paranasal sinuses, and that's where we would find it if we were to crack this bone open or saw it open or whatever. All right, so our next bone. Ah, sphenoid, that's really easy to see. See the greater wing, lesser wing, right? Optic canal right here, the pterygoid plates, or the pterygoid processes, I'm sorry, for attachment of the pterygoid muscles when we get to that. Okay, next bone. Yeah, parietal bone. It's just kind of a big flat bone. Doesn't have much in the way of many features on it. And then the temporal bone, right? You see a nice zygomatic arch, external acoustic meatus, the squamous region right here, mastoid process, and even a little bit of a styloid process, right, that's broken off. Okay. Yeah, mandible. You see the body of the mandible, mental foramen, mandibular foramen right here. Here's the angle. Here's the mandibular ramus, right? Mandibular condyle, coronoid process, mandibular notch. So you should be familiar with all these different things. Okay. All right, so it's probably sinking in a little bit. Occipital bone, nice foramen magnum. Occipital condyles for articulating with the first cervical vertebrae. What's the name for that first cervical vertebrae? The atlas. Yeah, holding up the head, okay. And then we've got this little dinky bone. And that is the lacrimal bone. Now, all the photographs that I have here are not necessarily to scale because if I were to take a picture at the same scale, we might not even see this little tiny lacrimal bone right there. But that's lacrimal bone, very, very thin bone. Okay, ethmoid bone. Might be turned around a little bit, but this is the anterior part here. Here's the posterior part. I see some little shelves down here. This would be the middle nasal conche. I see a shark's fin sticking up here. That's called the crista galli. And then these flat plates that are perpendicular to the crista galli, that's called the cribriform plate. And there's a bunch of little holes in that cribriform plate. Those are the olfactory foramina. And the sense of olfaction is what? Smell, yeah. So that these nerves actually can get down into your nasal cavity so that you can smell things. Okay, bone that kind of looks like an L. Okay, yeah, it's not really horseshoe shaped. It's really kind of an L. I had to shoot it at a little bit of an angle. This is a palatine bone. The palatine bone makes up the nasal cavity. It sits in your face kind of just like this, where the horizontal plates make the posterior part of the hard palate or roof of the mouth. These vertical plates make the walls, the posterior walls of the nasal cavity. All right, so that's a palatine bone. And then this one, actually is really small. I blew it up quite a bit here. Probably didn't need to do that, but it's very prominent on your face. That's a zygomatic bone, right? Zygomatic or cheekbone. funny kind of bone, has a lot of rough surfaces right here, forms a shelf inside your nasal cavity. It's a nasal conche, and it is the inferior nasal conche. It's the biggest one of the three, and it's a bone that's all by itself. It attaches to the ethmoid bone, but it's not really physically a part of the ethmoid bone, not like the superior nasal conche and middle nasal conche. All right, so that's the, no, superior and middle for the ethmoid. This is the inferior nasal conche. This one right here blew up real big again. You got two of these. Makes a bridge of the nose. That would be the nasal bone. Okay, so nasal bone. Yes, the nasal bone. Then we've got maxilla, right? Nice frontal process right here. Now the maxilla, I see a little inferior orbital foramen right here. Here's the orbital plate. And in this region right here, there's another big cavity. What's that cavity called? Another maxillary paranasal sinus, right? That's inside here. And remember, the paranasal sinuses are filled with lymphatic tissue that help protect you from infection when you're breathing bacteria and viruses in through your nose or through your mouth or whatever. Okay. Then we see a nice alveolar margin. These holes that the teeth fit in are called alveoli. So you should know some of the features of that bone. This would be better to have a video so you can see a three-dimensional picture of this one. This one is like a knife blade. It's really long and flat. And it makes the inferior part of the nasal septum, and it sticks out just a little bit anteriorly. What are the two bones that make the nasal septum up? The superior one is the ethmoid, the perpendicular plate of the ethmoid. And remember, that also forms the base of the anterior cranial fossa. It has that crista galli in it. All right, but the lower bone is the vomer. So you got ethmoid, and then you got the vomer below it. All right, so that's my picture of a vomer. This one right here, yeah, that's the hyoid. Hyoid bone, that's kind of inside your mandible right here, but don't go poking around in there because it's a fairly delicate bone. That almost could be like a mandible of a neonate, but it's not. That's actually the hyoid bone. Okay, oh, guess what? We're back to where we started from. So let's go through these really fast. What bone is that? Frontal. Okay. And what we got here? Sphenoid. And? Parietal. Temporal. Mandible. Occipital. Lacrimal. Ethmoid. Yeah, palatine bone. Zygomatic bone. Yeah, inferior nasal conche. Nasal bone. Maxilla. Yeah, that's a vomer. Hyoid. And maybe this is where we started. Yeah, that's where we started. Frontal bone. Okay, we'll look at that again maybe right after class. So let's see. Here's the sign-in sheet. Hold on to this for just a little bit and then start passing it around. All right, so if you want to practice those bones, take a look at that video. And there's there's an audio track and there's spelling as well on the video if you need to do that. All right, so one of the last things that we need to talk about in terms of the axial skeleton is probably the thoracic cage. We talked about vertebrae and things like that. And the thoracic cage is made up of ribs. And you should know how many pairs of ribs you have. How many pairs of ribs typically do we find? Okay, we have 24 ribs or 12 pairs. Yep, exactly right. So make sure you read the question on how, but usually I don't try to make it too tricky. All right, and so the head of a rib articulates with a vertebrae. What kind of vertebrae does a rib articulate with? What division? By definition, it's got to be thoracic, right? Can't be cervical, can't be lumbar, because then it wouldn't be a cervical or lumbar vertebrae. Okay, so the head of the rib articulates on the body, and this tubercle of a rib articulates with the transverse process, all right, and then curves around, and it might articulate with the breastbone, which is what we call the sternum, and the sternum has got three main parts to it. Superior part is the manubrium, the middle part is, and the largest part is the body. And then in the pre-adult, You have a little cartilage extension right here that we call the xiphoid process, and in the adult that ossifies, it becomes bone, and then it's used as a pretty strong muscle attachment for abdominal muscles. Just like pretty much every process in your body is used for that purpose. All right, so you might notice that there are a number of ribs that attach directly via some costal cartilage to the sternum, right? And as a matter of fact, the first 7 pairs of ribs do that. So we can count these down, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, and you can see there is a direct attachment to the sternum, although some of these costal cartilages are pretty long, right? Those we call true ribs. 1 through 7 are true. Furthermore, there are some inferior ribs, okay? So we said 7, 8, 9, 10, right? 8, 9, and 10 have cartilage, costal cartilage, but they don't articulate directly to the sternum. They articulate with the costal cartilage of number 7. So these we don't call true ribs, we call these false ribs. All right. Furthermore, there are the 2 remaining ribs right here are also false ribs because they don't attach directly to the sternum, but these 2 right here don't even have any kind of costal cartilage. So they're not only false, they're also called floating ribs. That's right. So make sure you check those out on the mannequin upstairs. All right, so those are the ribs and how it attaches to the vertebral column. Do I have a picture of a rib anywhere? Yeah, pretty much. All right, so here's the head of the rib. Here's the tubercle of the rib. So the head, you can see it articulating between 2 vertebral bodies. So these little facets on the vertebral body are called demifacets. All right, so because here's a demifacet right here because it doesn't articulate with 1 head of a rib, right? It only articulates with half of a head of a rib. And the vertebral body above it also participates in that joint as well. So it's like half of an articulation. It's not a whole articulation. You see a demifacet here on the superior vertebral body, and then there's another demifacet here on the inferior vertebral body. So both of these facets join together to form the joint with the head of the rib. And the rib has to course anteriorly, so here's the angle, here's the shaft of the rib, and the superior part of a rib is kind of blunt. It has a nice rounded surface, but this inferior part is really sharp. It's kind of like a knife edge. So you can tell what surface is superior and inferior depending on how sharp it looks. Maybe you can see that it's kind of sharp looking right here. And then this is easy actually to understand if you palpate with your fingertips. On the inside surface of this rib, right in here, and it kind of courses about to this region right here, is a depression we call the costal groove. You might have to know that little groove. Difficult to see on bones, but easy to feel with your fingertips. So when you go into lab, make sure you palpate that little costal groove. Okay. So I think that's it pretty much for axial skeleton. Unless somebody has a question about axial skeleton. All right, so we're going to move on to the appendicular skeleton. All right, so let's see. What are the bones of the axial skeleton in general terms? Yeah, skull, vertebrae, thoracic cage, rib cage, really good, which includes the sternum. And the 3 parts of that sternum that we were talking about. Yeah.
I have a really quick question.
Yeah.
The demifacet, can you tell me again what the difference between that and the regular facet?
Yeah. Let me see if I can find a pretty good. I think maybe the best picture I had was maybe this one right here. Okay. All right, so here we have a typical vertebrae. So let's look at this picture first. And, of course, we got the transverse processes, nice spinous process. The transverse process right here has a depression. We call that a facet. And it articulates with the tubercle of a rib. So one rib will articulate with one transverse process. All right, so this one rib, one depression, one joint. So we call that a facet. As opposed to these little depressions right here that are on the vertebral body. This is what we call a demifacet. And that's because the head of the rib does not or the head of one rib doesn't articulate with one vertebral body. It articulates at this location on this vertebral body, but also partly on a facet with the vertebral body on the vertebrae that's superior to it. So this joint actually what spans across this intervertebral space right here. And so we don't really call that a facet, we call that a demifacet, because it only participates in half of the joint. And then this inferior part right here, we call a demifacet because it actually forms what? The other half of the joint. So these two demifacets together make up the complete joint for this rib right here. Okay, so we call those demifacets as opposed to these over here on the transverse process. That's a true facet. Okay. How did I do that time? A little better? Good. Okay. Okay. All right. So axial skeleton is a skull, vertebral column, right? Rib cage, including the sternum. So the appendicular skeleton are all of the other bones that make up your body. And they're called the appendicular skeleton, so of course they make up your appendages. And the two appendages are your upper appendages, or commonly we call those arms, and your lower appendages, which we commonly call legs. But remember, an arm is a very specific term in anatomy. What is your arm? Between what two joints is your arm? Between your shoulder and your elbow. And what is between your elbow and your... Okay, forearm. But if you want to use even better, more particular language, you're welcome to do that. Like brachium and antebrachium, that would be really good. But arm and forearm is what I was thinking. Because I'm using these terms a little inappropriately, like arm for the whole upper appendage and leg for the whole lower appendage. So tell me, what is your leg in your lower appendage? Where do you find that? Between what two joints? Between your knee and your ankle. Yeah, so I want you to appreciate it. I'm using that terminology just a little loosely when I say arm and leg, right? Okay. So depending on how I ask the question, make sure you have that pretty straight in your mind. All right, so the appendicular skeleton has to attach to your axial skeleton. Let me get on the right set of pictures right here. We don't want this one necessarily. We want this one right here. Okay, so there are certain bones that help attach your appendages to your axial skeleton, and they kind of surround your body. All right, so when you surround something, there is a verb that means to surround something. All right, and does anybody, and we use it in anatomy, is to girdle something. To surround something is to girdle something. Or a structure that surrounds something is called a girdle. So there are girdles that surround your axial skeleton that help attach your appendicular skeleton to your axial skeleton, right? And there are two. There's a pectoral girdle, which attaches your upper appendage to your axial skeleton, and there's a pelvic girdle, which attaches your lower appendages to your axial skeleton. So you got to know the names of those bones and the joints associated with them. So here is a picture of the pectoral girdle. The two bones associated with them are the clavicle and the scapula right here. So the clavicle is anterior, the scapula is posterior. And the only joint that attaches your whole upper appendage, which is a pretty strong appendage, is this joint right here. That's the only joint. Right, so we call that the clavicular manubrial joint because it's between the clavicle and the manubrium right here. Other than that, it's muscles that hold your upper appendage to the rest of your body. Okay, so here is the clavicle. Notice it has a nice S kind of shape to it. And that's because, you know, it's pretty easy to fracture this bone. It's not very mobile. It's pretty immobile inside the body. And if you hit your shoulder really hard, it doesn't have any place to go and it fractures. There's a big blood vessel, big artery that's just right underneath the clavicle. And when you break a bone, of course, it's very sharp, and that large blood vessel could be lacerated and you could bleed to death rather quickly. But because the shape of this bone, you see that's that nice S right here, when it fractures, fortunately it doesn't fracture internally or inferiorly, it always has a tendency to fracture outward. And therefore that blood vessel never gets damaged. All right, so that's pretty interesting how this bone has evolved to protect that little blood vessel. And remember I said that it's really important to study your bones thoroughly in anatomy, because you can use your knowledge of bones to automatically learn a lot of other kinds of anatomy, like vascular anatomy and neuroanatomy. So you could probably even tell me the name of that blood vessel that runs underneath the clavicle right there. It's called the subclavian artery and subclavian vein. All right, so that's how, so actually a lot of things in anatomy sort of get a little bit easier as you go along. Okay, make sure you take a look at this bone in lab, because you can't appreciate it very well from these pictures. The sternal end, which is the end that articulates with the manubrium right here, kind of looks like the opening of a clarinet or a trumpet. It's flared, it's very, very broad. But the acromial end right here is very flat, kind of looks like a knife blade, which you can't really appreciate from this picture. So in lab, make sure you know the difference between the sternal end and this acromial end. We call this the acromial end because it articulates with this big process right here on the scapula. And guess what we call that? That's the acromion process. Yeah, acromion process. All right, so hence this is the acromial end of the sternum. All right, so here are some pictures. So here is the other bone that makes up the girdle, the superior girdle. What do we call that superior girdle again? Pectoral girdle, right? Because it's surrounding your body anteriorly and posteriorly. You know, mostly it does. All right, so in lab, make sure you can pick up a scapula and place it on your body like how it would fit normally. So you should know what the anterior side is, posterior side, lateral, superior, and inferior. Right, but once you do that, I think you'll be able to do that pretty easily. There's one side that's really easy to tell because it has this depression right here. We call this the glenoid cavity, and it's a smooth depression. This is the main articulation that you have with your upper appendage. This is where the humerus articulates with the scapula. So this is a depression. So sometimes, actually a lot of times, we don't call this a cavity. We would call this the glenoid. What's another name for depression? Fossa. I would say fossa. It's labeled cavity in your book, but if you would just say fossa on a test, that would be perfectly fine. Okay. So that's a glenoid fossa. So what side of the bone is this? Is this going to be medial or lateral? Where are your arms attached? Lateral or medial? Yeah, lateral, right? So the glenoid fossa is a really nice handy landmark for knowing what the lateral side of the scapula is, of course. And then if you go to the other side, here's what the medial border, right? Medial border. This would be the lateral border because it lines up with the glenoid fossa. And then this very sharp angle down here, inferior angle, that's the inferior part of the scapula. That's pretty easy to see. All right. We need to know a couple other landmarks. Here is a big ridge that's very prominent, sticks off the scapula. This is what we call the spine, scapular spine. Another important landmark because that marks the posterior part of the scapula. And that's really handy because even on yourself, you can feel that thing sticking out right there. All right, so from those landmarks, you can orient the scapula perfectly on your body. All right, the scapular spine ends eventually right here on the acromion process. And the other process that is anterior to the acromion is pretty massive, but not quite as massive. This is the coracoid process. So what do you think the function of the coracoid process is and the acromion process and the spine of the scapula? What's the function of all these things? Muscle attachments. Yeah, muscle attachments, and there's also going to be some ligaments in there, but just automatically say muscle attachments. We have some depressions in the scapula. All right, so we said this is the posterior side, so this right here is the anterior side. It forms a bowl, and there are a couple other little bowls here and here. These are for holding something in particular, muscles. All right, so this anterior side has a subscapular fossa because it holds a muscle. And since you know the name of that depression, the subscapular fossa, you already know the name of that muscle. It's called the subscapularis. Right, so that's really cool. Over here we have two more fossa, the supraspinous fossa, which is aptly named because it's above the spine of the scapula. You know the name of that muscle in there as well. That's the supraspinatus. And the fossa below the scapular spine, that's called the infraspinous fossa. And guess what? You know the name of that muscle now, too. That's the infraspinatus. All right, so we're making muscles look really easy just by knowing our bones really, really well. Okay. All right, so here's just a nice lateral view. How do you know this is a lateral view? Just pretend you can't read. Because you're looking right into the glenoid cavity or the glenoid fossa, right? So here's a nice lateral view of the scapula, and you can see what the supraspinous fossa, the infraspinous fossa right here, and the subscapular fossa right in this location if you look, right? Okay, so you got some good important muscles right there. And these muscles, what, always need attention in somebody. In what way? Okay. Yeah, they hold up your shoulder, but those are the ones that people always like to, when they get their back rubbed, right, to be massaged, because they're right there, right, these muscles. And they're working all the time, making sure that you don't lose your upper appendage, holding that onto your body. All right, the next bone in your upper appendage is the humerus. And in your arm, you only have one bone, and that is the humerus. Right here is the proximal epiphysis, distal epiphysis, and this is the head of the humerus, which articulates with the glenoid fossa, and that forms a nice ball and socket joint. We see a couple of prominent areas right here, some processes that are rough, and this is what we call the greater tubercle and the lesser tubercle. These are for muscle attachment, for moving the humerus around, and a nice depression that's in between them. We call that the intertubercular groove, or you could call it the intertubercular sulcus. There's a very important tendon that runs between the tubercles right here that attaches to the biceps muscle. All right, so when we get to the biceps, we're going to be interested in that tendon that slips right through here. When we get down to the diaphysis, about mid-diaphysis and lateral, and a little bit anterior, but mostly lateral on the humerus, we see another raised rough area. What's that for? Muscle attachment. Oh, what's the name of that process right there? We call that the deltoid tuberosity. And now you know what muscle attaches right there. Guess what muscle attaches right there?
Deltoid.
The deltoid muscle, right, for doing that kind of motion. Okay. So when these things are exam figures, you don't have to know every particular name for all of these structures, but just the ones that are in your lab manual. All right, so when you're studying for the next test, all right, make sure you know at least the ones that are in your lab manual, because those will be important to know. If we look at the distal epiphysis of this humerus right here, we see all kinds of nifty structures. But let's look at these smooth articulating areas, right, down over here. These are going to be analogous to the head of the humerus, which is smooth. That's for an articulation. These are going to be articulating with the bones in the forearm. And there are two articulating surfaces. There's one that kind of looks like a ball right here, very spherical. That's the capitulum. And then there's one next to it right here, kind of looks like a bobbin that you might wind some thread up on. That's called the trochlea. All right, so the capitulum here articulates with the radial bone, and the trochlea is going to articulate with the ulna. So I'm going to have to tell you something about the radius and the ulna, and maybe we're going to go to that slide next, right, after I just mention a couple other things. So here are the capitulum and trochlea. You could consider these condyles because they're smooth articulating surfaces. And above these condyles are these ridges right here that are prominent and very rough. These are used for muscle attachments. So these are what we call epicondyles, right? Because a condyle is a smooth articulating surface. What's the name of that smooth articulating surface on the mandible? Okay. Yeah, it's on the superior aspect of the ramus. Okay. And I tell you what, what's the name of that joint? What's the only movable bone in the skull? The mandible is the only movable one. It articulates with what other bone? The temporal bone. So we call that the temporomandibular joint, yeah, or TMJ. All right, so the mandible has a nice smooth surface that articulates with the mandibular fossa, and we call that the mandibular condyle. Okay, mandibular condyle is that smooth surface on the mandible for the TMJ. So these really are condyles right here, but they have specific names because that elbow joint is a pretty fancy joint. All right. Well, I went into that little discussion because I wanted you to know that these are epicondyles and how easy it is to name them. All right. So one is medial and one is lateral. How are you going to know which one is which? Refer to the head of the humerus. That's a nice easy landmark. And what's that? Is that going to be medial or lateral? Yeah, medial, because it's going to articulate with the scapula. It's got to face medially. So here is the medial aspect of the humerus, and then here is the lateral, right? So here's the lateral over here. Of the condyles on this distal epiphysis right here, the capitulum is which one? Lateral or medial? Lateral. That's going to be important. You're going to have to match that up with the radius. And then the medial one is the trochlea. The trochlea is the medial condyle. All right, let's look at some of the bones in the forearm. Here's the forearm. Here we got twice as many, right? Namely two. You got the radius and the ulna. So how are you going to remember which one of these is medial and lateral? Well, many times you might be interested to know what your heart rate is. And you might kind of be familiar with what we call that sometimes. All right, how would you take somebody's pulse or heart rate or your own? A couple different ways. You can do a nice central pulse maybe in your neck, all right? But if you have a healthy person, it's just as easy to grab their forearm, right? And where would you palpate? By their little finger or by their thumb? And which way is your thumb pointing in anatomic position? Yeah, we call that laterally, of course, in anatomy, right? Okay, you could say outward, but say laterally. All right, so you would palpate this pulse as lateral pulse. And some of you might know that we call that the radial pulse, not because it's like a spokes on a bicycle or something. Radial because it's named after the bone that is the lateral bone in your forearm, which is the radius, right? So thumb is lateral, radius is lateral. We call that the radial pulse because we name that artery that courses underneath the radial bone the radial artery, right? So that's very easy to palpate. So maybe from that you can remember that the radius is lateral, which means then that the ulna, this one right here, is the medial bone in the forearm. Okay. So let's look at the head of the radius right here. Notice, can you get the impression that it's nice and round and there is the articulating surface in the head of the radius right here, which is a depression, which fits very nicely in with this spherical structure, the capitulum. So the head of the radius articulates with the capitulum very, very nicely. That's going to make perfect sense if you put those two bones together in lab or if you look at the skeleton that we have standing in lab for you. Okay, the medial bone is the ulna, and there's a big notch in the ulna right here. Maybe I can go to the next slide. Oh, yeah, look at this big notch right here. Kind of looks like a big C. All right, that big notch fits right into the trochlea. So we call this the trochlear notch because it articulates with the trochlea on the humerus right there. All right, so make sure you can match up capitulum and trochlea with its respective bones that make up the elbow joint. Okay, so here is the head of the radius. We got the coronoid process right here on the ulna. Here it is all by itself. But this whole process back over here on the posterior part of the ulna, we call this the olecranon process. And that's a invariably abused part of your body. Because what do you do with that thing all the time? Yeah, you bend it, but you bang it into stuff. Okay? That's that big bony thing right here that's sticking out. Right? And there's even a nerve that runs through there that you pinch sometimes and you feel some electricity because you pinch it up against the olecranon process. Okay. So when your arm is straight like this, this olecranon process, right, actually has to fit into a part, a little depression on the posterior part of the humerus. All right, so what did we call this process right here? This is the olecranon process. And when your arm is straight, it fits into the olecranon fossa in the posterior part of the humerus right there. All right, I don't know if you have pictures of these things. So you got the olecranon process, which is posterior. What is that smaller process on the ulna that is sticking anteriorly? Yeah, that coronoid process. All right? And so when your arm is bent like that, that process has to fit into a fossa on the anterior side of the humerus. And here is that little depression right here called the coronoid fossa. Okay? And correspondingly, the head of the radius, when your arm is bent, has to fit into the radial fossa of the humerus right here. All right, so I don't have a really nice video to show you how these articulations work, but here's that coronoid process, so that when you bend your arm, it's got to fit into the coronoid fossa. And the head of the radius, when your arm is bent, has to fit into the radial fossa of the humerus right here. Okay, so make sure you put these bones together in lab. All right, the distal part of the ulna and radius. Here is the head of the ulna. All right, so notice, let me go back one slide. Notice that the head of the radius is proximal, but the head of the ulna is what? Is distal, that they switch ends. All right, and that's because in your forearm, you can undergo a motion that we call pronation and supination. I'll define some of these terms for you really, really soon. But pronation is when you turn your palms of your hands so they face what? Posteriorly. So the ulna, actually the radius crosses over the ulna when you pronate and supinate. So these things rotate with respect to each other. So that's why the head of the radius is nice and round so that you can pronate and supinate. And the head of the ulna is nice and round so that you can pronate and supinate so these bones can cross over each other. There is a ligament between these two bones, and this ligament is not really very strong because it can't be really super strong because then you couldn't pronate and supinate. So we call that the interosseous membrane. It's strong enough to keep the ulna and radius together, but weak enough so that you can still pronate and supinate. Okay, one last other landmark, which you can feel in your wrists right here. The styloid processes. Right. Here's the styloid process on the ulna. Here's the styloid process of the radius. And that helps stabilize the wrist joint. Okay, so that's pretty much it for bones of the arm. Okay, so let's go to our hand. And hand and wrist. Maybe I'll just say hands and wrist. We have a number of wrist bones. There are eight of them. And all eight of these bones are called carpals. And that's what you have to know, with the exception of the name for one of them, which is this guy right here. That's called a scaphoid. So I'm not going to test you in lab, if you're my lab students, on all the names of those carpals or in lecture. But you have to know that bones of the wrist, which you should be able to identify all these here as being wrist bones, that those are carpals. Okay? In particular, the scaphoid is noteworthy because it's problematic. I see another view of the scaphoid right here. Notice how narrow and thin it gets as it forms the joint, which means that if you apply a lot of blunt force to a wrist, like if you fall and cut yourself, you apply a lot of force to this scaphoid, right? The radius jams right into it. It has a tendency to fracture. That's the easiest bone in the wrist to fracture. There's a blood vessel that goes into the scaphoid, and when the scaphoid breaks, it damages that blood vessel. So what can you tell me about the recuperative properties of the scaphoid when that blood vessel gets damaged? It has a tendency not to grow back. So the scaphoid degenerates. It dissolves away when the scaphoid is fractured. So usually people have problems with their wrist right for the rest of their life because the scaphoid just kind of dissolves away. So I think it's important that you know at least the name of that one carpal right there, the scaphoid. All right, so these are all carpals. Then we have bones that make up the hand proper. Okay, these are bones of the hand. We call those metacarpals. And guess how many you got? They match up with your fingers. The proper name for a finger is a digit. So you have five digits, you have five metacarpals, and we name them starting with the thumb. They don't have special names, right? This is just the first metacarpal, second metacarpal, all the way to number five, corresponding to your smallest digit right here. All right, so the naming of these bones is really simple, but for some reason, students freak out on a practicum or a lecture test, and they forget how to number them. or they forget what's the difference between a carpal and a metacarpal and a bone that actually makes up a digit. All right, so I want to tell you the name of a bone that makes up a digit is called a phalanx. Is singular, phalanges is plural for phalanx. All right, so the bones that actually make up a finger, all right, are called phalanges. The bones that make up your hand are called metacarpals, and bones that make up the wrist are carpals. Okay, so look at this picture a number of times, and for sure in lab, make sure you can tell the difference between a hand and a foot, because they kind of look similar. Why do they kind of look similar? Because they have same what? They have the same what am I thinking of? Ah, okay, phalanges, you're pretty close, but I'm thinking digits. I'm thinking fingers and toes as being digits. A foot has five digits, and a hand, of course, has five digits as well. Okay, so that's why they're kind of easy to mix up. Say it again. Oh, okay, yeah, say it out loud if that helps you remember, that's fine. All right, so here is number one, metacarpal, number two, three, four, five, all the way over to your little finger. Okay, now the bones that actually make up a digit. Let's take a look at digit number, which number is this right here? Yeah, number three. Okay, I see three bones that make up a digit. Here is the number three proximal phalanx, here's the number three middle phalanx, and here is the number three distal phalanx. So that's how we would name all those bones. So I tell you what, what's this one right here? What number? Start with a number. Number five, distal phalanx. Yeah. Okay, and I suppose you might want to say of the hand or foot if you're ever asked, right? Maybe you're looking at just a plain x-ray film or something and you can't really tell. You might want to describe what you're looking at to be thorough. Yeah. Yeah, let's go back to number one. That's kind of strange. Now, you know your number one is a lot different because it can oppose the other four digits. So here is number one, what, metacarpal? So that's not a phalanx, but here are the phalanges here. I just see a proximal and a distal. There is no middle. So you're exactly right about that. Okay, so number one digit only has two. And I think you can see that a little bit more clearly on this the posterior view right here. All right, so that's the hand. Covered it really fast. It's pretty simple, but I don't know, you have to look at it. Make sure you understand what I'm talking about, because it's problematic for some students. I don't really know why. Okay. All right, so that's the upper appendage, which then leads us to the lower appendage. And just like there is a girdle that attaches your upper appendage to your exoskeleton, there is a girdle for your lower appendages as well. What do we call that girdle? Pelvic girdle. And it's a girdle because it does what? It surrounds your axial skeleton. So this right here, we see some parts of the axial skeleton, namely the sacrum and the coccyx right here. That's actually part of your axial skeleton. But then we see some bones of the appendicular skeleton, namely an ascoxae. So here's a hip bone or an ascoxae. This would be a left one. Here's the right one over here. So if we put the two ascoxae together, okay, with the sacrum and the coccyx here, we call that a pelvis. All right, so that's a pelvis. And in lab, you have to be able to tell the difference between male and female. What's the best way to tell? Easiest way from across the room. Yeah, look at the pubic arch right here. If it's greater than 90 degrees, it's female. If it's 90 degrees or less, it's a male. But other ways you can tell is that the female pelvis is wider and shorter. The male pelvis is, what, taller and narrower, and other features which you can look at in lab. So I think that's really all I'm going to say about a pelvis, but I want to get back to that pelvic girdle. The pelvic girdle is made up of the ascoxae right here. All right, so this is the bone that attaches your lower appendage, which is about here, to your axial skeleton. At this joint right here, which is what we call the sacroiliac joint. So the pelvic bone, or ascoxae, is actually made from three bones during development. There are three bones that make up the ascoxae, and I think we have the next slide that shows that right here. Okay, and it's nicely color-coded. The three bones that fuse together are the ilium, which we see right here, which is the superior bone. the pubis, which is the anterior bone, and then the most inferior bone is what we call the ischium. So ilium, pubis, and ischium make up the three bones that fuse together to form the os coxae. All right, so this bone is pretty confusing, and you, in lab, you got to pick it up and put it on your body the way that it would fit on your person. All right, so again, you're going to look for some landmarks, just like for the scapula. There's a nice landmark that signifies the lateral part of this bone. That lateral part of the os coxae is going to articulate with your leg, or your, in particular your femur. So there's a socket that's lateral. That socket, we don't call it a glenoid fossa or cavity. We call it the acetabulum. All right, so here is the acetabulum. And so this is lateral. The superior part of the bone is the ilium right here. This is what we call the iliac crest. And that's a really good landmark. And then the pubic bone is anterior. So by knowing those three landmarks, you can rotate that os coxae, put it on your body, and it's going to make a lot of sense. All right, so we said that the pubic bone is what? Anterior or posterior?
Anterior.
So this is going to be like the anterior side. This is going to be the posterior side. And we see some other important landmarks. All right, let's start on the anterior side. Here's a bump. All right, it's a nice spine. It's a process. Guess what this is used for? Muscle attachment. Okay. Here's another bump or process on the bone. What's its function? Muscle attachment, right? This one right here, that we said this is the anterior part of the os coxae, so this is the anterior iliac spine, but notice that there are two. So here is the anterior superior, here is the anterior inferior iliac spine, right? Because it's below this superior one. All right, and if we go to the posterior side of the ilium, we see a couple prominences right here used for muscle attachments. This is the superior iliac spine, but it's on the posterior side. Here is the posterior inferior iliac spine. All right, so I think once you see that symmetry, it's pretty easy to appreciate those bumps right there. Well, we see some other bumps, namely this one right here. But is this one on the ilium? This is on the ischium, right? It's a bit inferior to the ilium right here, so this is not a posterior or superior, right, or anterior or whatever, iliac spine. This is actually the ischial spine. And this is really easy because there's only one on the ischium, right? And that's it, right there. An easy way to find this ischial spine is to look at these large indentations, this one on the ilium, this one on the ischium right here. This is what we call the greater sciatic notch because it's very big, and then here's a smaller one that's inferior to it. This is the lesser sciatic notch. So where do you find that ischial spine? Nicely positioned right between those sciatic notches, right? So it's pretty easy to picture that, but you got to look at this diagram, right, a couple times. Otherwise, you're going to miss these superior and inferior iliac spines and this ischial spine right here, okay? This hole is the obturator foramen. Guess what the name of an artery is that goes through there? Yeah, the obturator artery, okay? You might have to know that one in lab, maybe. Okay, then this depression is the acetabulum, and this area right here, the ischial tuberosity, that's a very rough, raised, prominent area on the ischium. Guess what the function of that is? Muscle attachment, very powerful muscles that position the thigh. Right here, because this is the ischium, pubis, what else do I want to say about this? The medial side of the ilium, kind of like a fan, there's a depression for holding pelvic organs. We call that the iliac fossa. All right, but this fan, actually, especially if we look from the lateral side of the os coxa, we call that the ala. All right, so the ala is lateral. That depression that's medial is called the iliac fossa. And then, of course, here is a nice smooth area right here for articulating with the sacrum. Okay, so this is what we call the articular surface. Another articular surface that's going to articulate with the opposite pubic bone, right? So that's what helps form the pubic symphysis when the two os coxae come together. This is kind of an interesting joint because it actually dissolves. It disappears in some people. When does it dissolve and disappear in some people? Remember, the pubic bone is anterior. It dissolves and disappears during parturition, during childbirth, right? And that enlarges what we call the pelvic outlet. Okay, so here's that pubic symphysis right here. And so that allows the os coxae to rotate and separate from each other, and that enlarges, right, the area for delivery through the pelvic outlet of the pelvis right here. And then after that, it comes back together again, mostly. Okay. All right, so let's talk about the bone in the thigh. And just like in your upper appendage, you have the humerus. In the thigh, you have the femur. It looks kind of similar. Here is the head of the femur, right, and the neck of the femur. Let me just go back really quick to the humerus. I forgot to mention this. All right, so here you have the head of the humerus and then a narrowing that attaches the head to the rest of the body. What do you call that structure that attaches your head to the rest of your body? And it's narrow. We call that the neck. Okay, I'm just being very general. That's your neck, okay? So the femur and the humerus have a neck. It's just a narrowing right here. But notice that the neck on the humerus is very, very short, and it's not really all that much narrower than the head and the rest of the humerus. But nonetheless, right, that is a narrowing right there. So we call that the anatomic neck. It doesn't fracture very easily because it's so massive. This narrowing right here does have a tendency to fracture. So we call that the surgical neck. The femur, however, doesn't have a similar kind of structure. Right? This is just what we call the neck of the femur. And because it is a lot narrower than the other corresponding or neighboring parts of the femur, fractures do occur there. So there really is no corresponding surgical neck on the femur. I see a little pit right here. We call that the fovea capitis. That little pit is a space where a very strong ligament spans from the head of the femur into the acetabulum. Remember, the acetabulum is a depression that holds the head of the femur, right, which causes this little depression right here. And there is also an important artery that goes through that ligament from the os coxae into the hip. And when somebody damages their hip, it can damage that blood vessel. And as a result, when that blood vessel is damaged, maybe to the point to where it can't carry blood anymore, guess what you can tell? What can you tell me about the head of the femur when it loses its blood supply? It actually dies because it's filled. Remember, it's living tissue. And when the head of the femur dies, it just dissolves away. And what are you left with? Just a big jagged stump right there. Okay. So what do people need when the head of their femur just dissolves away? We call that bone necrosis. Then they need hip replacement, right? There was a very famous athlete who was just a super athlete. He played both professional football and professional baseball, even in the same season. Yeah, Bo Jackson. And he got tackled one time really severely in the hip, and it damaged that blood vessel. And it destroyed the head of his femur right here to where he needed a hip replacement. But he was such a phenomenal athlete that even with a prosthetic hip, he went back and played professional baseball, which is pretty amazing that somebody could be that athletic and just even work with an artificial hip. But I suppose, you know, if you're getting paid millions of dollars to play a baseball, well, I'd play baseball even if I didn't get paid. But if I got paid $1 million, that would even be more fun, right? So even with an artificial hip, I suppose, that's a lot of motivation. But nonetheless, he was a phenomenal athlete. Okay, so a lot of people can recover with artificial hips really, really nicely. All right, these bony prominences right here, we don't call these tubercles like we do on the humerus. We call these trochanters. They're bigger, more massive. All right, what's the function of a trochanter? Muscle attachment, very strong, powerful muscles, right? Here's a line that's raised and very rough. What's the function of this line right here? Muscle attachment as well. This is what we call the linea aspera. All right, that's on the posterior part of the femur. And then we have some smooth articulating surfaces, which again we call condyles on the femur, on the distal end. And this condyle, what are we going to name this condyle right here if we had it erased? Your choices would be medial and lateral. And how would you know? Yeah, look at the head of the femur right here. So this is medial. So here's the medial condyle. Here's a lateral condyle. These bony ridges above it, again, are called epicondyles. The notch between the condyles we call the intercondylar fossa or maybe groove. And let's see, what else do I want to say? Anteriorly, we have a kind of a funny bone that makes your kneecap right here. That bone is surrounded by a tendon, dense regular connective tissue. And so, as such, what did we call a bone that we find in a tendon or a ligament? A sesamoid bone. Right, so this patella is a sesamoid bone, but it does articulate. Here's the articulating surface on the anterior part of the femur. Right, so here's the articulating surfaces. How would you be able to tell the anterior versus the posterior side of a patella with your eyes closed? So I would say roughness. One surface is going to be rough and the other is going to be smooth. How would you know which is which? Well, the posterior side of the patella is going to rub up against this patellar surface on the femur, so should that be rough or smooth? That should be really, really smooth. Smooth, 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 right? So that when it rubs up against it, it just slips and slides over it. But this anterior side is going to be really rough because those ligaments, right, and tendons attach to this surface of the patella. Okay, but nonetheless, that is a sesamoid bone. I saw a couple other little sesamoid bones. All right, right here are some little sesamoid bones in the thumb that help stabilize this joint in the thumb. And that's about the only places that you normally find sesamoid bones, but they can develop in joints that are repetitively used and maybe repetitively used in the wrong way. So inflammation can cause the formation of sesamoid bones in other joints in your body. All right, so how many bones do you have in your forearm? In your forearm? I would say two, right? Ulna and radius. So, correspondingly, in your leg, how many bones do you have? You got two, right? So I'm using that pretty particular. So don't forget, in the forearm, it's radius and ulna. Radius is lateral, all right? You got to understand exactly that same thing for the leg as well. Two bones, the tibia and fibula. The medial bone is the tibia. And sometimes that's confusing for students, but there's a way you can maybe tell on an exam, and that is just palpate your leg. You feel a very big bone in your leg, right? And that's lateral. The smaller bone, I'm sorry, medial. Okay, the tibia is medial, the fibula is lateral. And if you feel the lateral part of your leg, you just feel muscle, no bones whatsoever. So the fibula you can't even palpate because it's surrounded by muscle. But the tibia you can, and you can actually feel that the tibia is medial. All right, so here's tibia and fibula over here. There are condyles on the head of the tibia for articulating with the condyles of the femur. All right, so this would be the medial condyle. Here's a lateral condyle. And there is a raised area between the condyles. We call that the intercondylar eminence. And that's for attachments of some very strong ligaments that are going to help stabilize the knee joint, and that's going to be our next chapter when we get into joints. Okay, tibial tuberosity near the head of the tibia. And these bony prominences right here, you are familiar with looking at your ankle joints. Right, so here's the medial, what we call malleolus, makes that bony prominence that's sticking out, kind of like on your ankle. And then here's the lateral malleolus. All right, what else do you have to know about these things? That's pretty much about it for these two bones. But just like there is an interosseous membrane between the radius and ulna, there is an interosseous membrane between the tibia and fibula right here. Okay. All right, so here we got a hand.
Foot.
Very good. Okay. Somebody's still paying attention a little bit. All right. Let's talk Let's compare the hand and the foot. Since I have a foot right here. All right, now in the wrist, what are the bones in the wrist called?
Carpals.
The bones in the ankle, however, are not carpals. They are called tarsals. And you have to know the names of two of them. All right, the talus right here articulates with the tibia and fibula. Let's go back. It's going to fit right in here. So it's kind of dome-shaped. It's going to fit right in here. That's for the talus. All right, and another bone that forms your heel, this is what you hit the ground with, that's what we call the calcaneus. So those two bones you have to be able to identify, but also know that they are tarsals. Then the bones of the foot proper are metatarsals, and again, they're named 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, starting with the great toe, or you could say big toe. So here, 1 through 5 metatarsals. And the phalanges are very similar to the phalanges that you have, the digits that make up the hand. So you have a number 1 proximal phalanx, number 1 distal. And then here's a number 2 proximal, number 2 middle phalanx, and number 2 distal, right? So these are all number 2. Number 2 proximal, number 2 middle, number 2 distal phalanx. Okay, so these make up the toes or the digits. Just another aspect here, you can see the calcaneus and the talus above it. These are all tarsals. Metatarsals, this is your little toe, so that's the fifth metatarsal right here. Okay, there are some arches of the foot. Okay, you got a longitudinal arch, a transverse arch, and lateral arch. If you have a normal foot, and these various arches just help distribute weight on your foot, okay, for proper posture. That's why these arches are there. And I think that's it for appendicular skeleton. So let me give you a couple. Oh, I tell you what, let's do that flash quiz really fast before you go. The hardest thing, I think, is in appendicular skeleton is the adcoxae. Make sure you know all those little bumps, like the superior, anterior iliac spine, right? The anterior, inferior iliac spine. The other hard thing I think students have a tendency to mix up is the joint at the elbow. Make sure you know that the head of the radius articulates with what on the humerus? It articulates with the capitulum. And the trochlear notch on the ulna articulates with the trochlea on the humerus, right? So if you can't remember that, maybe you should draw that out. So if you draw it a couple times, that really helps solidify that image in your memory. All right, so do we have time to go over skull bones? Yeah, I'm sure we do. Here it is right here. All right, where's the sign-in sheet at? Somebody's got the sign-in sheet, bring it down. Yeah, bring it down when you're done. You know, we got time to do this probably 10 times. So the first time, I won't go so fast. So you tell me what you see. What's that? Frontal bone. And then we've got sphenoid. How's that? Is that easy so far? It's really easy so far. Okay, then we got the parietal bone. And then the temporal bone. Mandible. This is so easy so far. Okay, let's see if we can get it a little bit more difficult. I couldn't get it more difficult. That's the occipital bone. Oh, lacrimal. That's pretty strange. Okay. Next one. Ethmoid bone. Palatine. The palatine bones, right, that make up your nasal cavity. Also, roof of the mouth. This makes up the roof of the mouth or hard palate right here. And then cheekbone, zygomatic bone. Inferior nasal conchae forms that little plate inside your nasal cavity. And then nasal bone makes the bridge of the nose. Like here would be like a little nostril right here forming. And maxilla. Vomer, inferior nasal septum. Hyoid bone. Okay, so now we can go pretty fast. But I want to stop you. What are the four bones in your skull that have nasal sinuses, paranasal sinuses? Frontal bone, maxilla, the ethmoid, which is right here, and then the sphenoid that goes all the way across has them. So those four bones have paranasal sinuses. Okay, now let's name these really fast. Frontal, sphenoid, parietal, temporal, mandible, occipital, lacrimal, ethmoid, palatine, zygomatic, inferior nasal conchae, nasal, maxilla, vomer, hyoid. Okay, we've got time one more time, really fast. But if you're getting seasick, don't watch. Okay? Yeah, long one. Inferior nasal conchae. Okay, we took a breath. Don't want anybody passing out. Then we got a couple more. Nasal. Maxilla. All right, that's it. So check those out, and we'll see you Monday.